We're so thankful that you've given us yet another opportunity to gather together and to study these things. Father, we pray that your hand would be upon this evening, Father, and that your spirit would guide us as we discover the truth from the ancient past. Father, these things are not unimportant to us, Lord, because you've chosen to make them the backdrop of your word. So, Father, it's our prayer tonight that each person here would get a deeper insight into the plan that you have for our lives, into historical trends that are taking place today, even as we study. And Father, we do that through an accurate study of history. So Lord, just bless our class tonight, and we do all things to the glory of your Son's name. And we pray, amen. Okay, tonight, I hope everybody had a lot of fun with that short reading assignment you had for tonight. I hope that you got to read through it. If not, that will probably... I haven't checked it out on the syllabus, but that's probably the easiest week you're going to have. I mean, the most difficult week you're going to have. I know some nights you're only going to have like 7 pages. Some weeks you'll only have like 7 pages. Other weeks you'll have like 10 because we're studying this thematically, okay? Now, we need to move right along, though, because we want to cover all of this tonight, and there's a lot here. It may not look like it, but there are. So what I put up on the board here is an outline that I'm going to be using as I teach. Some of these places you may not be familiar with. Some of the people I know you're not familiar with because they're not in your book. But they're very important in history. And I don't think we'd be doing justice to the Sumerian civilization without plugging them in. Okay? So we're gonna do an overview of the Sumerians tonight. We're going to begin by talking about Noah just a little bit. We're going to go through Sargon. We're going to talk about Sumer regaining their power and just some sub-points into that. And then we're going to bring it to a close and we're going to get things ready for Hammurabi. Hammurabi is going to bring in the Babylonian Empire and the Semitic peoples are going to now begin to rule the Fertile Crescent and all of Mesopotamia. One other thing I wanted to mention before we begin tonight is it's very helpful for you, if you have the time, to make a map. What I mean by that is you see that I've given you some maps there tonight, copies of some maps. They're the best that we could find as far as being a nice, easy-to-trace map. What would be really to your benefit would be to take a piece of paper, put it over that, draw out the map, just draw it out, and then label the places. And by doing this, I don't know what it is, but it works with students in school. I just know it works. It works for me. When you have to write it down and you have to draw it out and you have to label it, you learn the places. That's all there is to it. I don't know how it works, but it's some kind of cognitive magic that it ends up getting in there, okay? So it would be to your benefit to do that. It would definitely be to your benefit to be familiar with the area of the Mediterranean Sea during the study. I would say no further than the Iberian Peninsula, which is where Spain is. So if you know from like the Iberian Peninsula all the way over to like Palestine and the Mesopotamia, the land between the rivers, when I mention some of these places to you and some of these people and where they settled, it's going to be very, very meaningful to you. So this week, if you have time to do that, make yourself a map. And then another thing you can do is after you make that map, take the map, crinkle it up, throw it away, and make another one, and don't label it. Just take it and put the other map away and see if you can make yourself a list of all the places that you have to put on there and see if you can put them on the map without any help. And that way there, you really learn a little bit of the geography here. It's really not that difficult. All we're looking at is the Mediterranean. But okay, we want to jump right into it, and we ended off last time by talking a little bit about races, and we talked about how within the genes of Adam and Eve was the potential for the entire human race, and that potential was pretty close to being replicated by Noah and his three sons, because we see that all of the races of the world are going to spring up from these three people. Now we're going to see some unbelievably amazing things. I wish that we could jump to Canaan tonight, but we can't. We have to plug in Abraham first. But after Abraham, we're going to learn about Canaan, and when we get a grasp of Canaan, big chunks of the Bible are going to come to life for you. I promise. The Canaanitish people were the people that God had in the world at the time when Abraham goes over after he leaves Hebron and goes down into Palestine. And we're going to see, for example, the Amorites were no more than the Canaanitish people who lived in the hills. And all of these very important people were Canaanites. And we're going to see something even more astonishing, and that is there is an unbelievable curse, not next week, but probably the week after, we'll see there's an unbelievable curse that is put upon the people of Canaan. And as we study history, you're just going to see how the Semitic and Japhetic people are just constantly wiping out the Hamites. And we're going to see where these people settled, and all of this is going to become very meaningful to you. That's why I'm encouraging you this week, if you have the time, make yourself a map and become familiar with the geography, so that if I mention the Peloponnesian Peninsula, you know that I'm talking about the area where Greece is. All these are just in the area of the Mediterranean Sea. So Noah, after the flood, ends up on Mount Ararat, and he and his sons migrate down into the area between the two rivers, the area that we call Mesopotamia. Your book said we have the Tigris and the Euphrates River, the two great rivers that meet together with the Persian Gulf to the south of them. Okay, these two rivers, all of the land in between those rivers is known as Mesopotamia. Meso is a Greek word meaning middle of the two rivers, the land between the two rivers. Now, it's very significant that we understand that all of the major civilizations that have ever existed spring up by the fertile valley regions of the world. For example, in Egypt, we're going to see next week, the people of the Nile. They all come around the Nile because the Nile inundates, first of all, once a year, it inundates the entire land with water, giving them an excellent opportunity for the bottom of the Nile comes up, that real fertile soil comes up and deposits itself all over the land. So that when after the Nile recedes, they have incredibly fertile land that they can plant. Also, the Tigris and Euphrates River, we have the same thing. This whole area is called the Fertile Crescent. Why? Because it comes up, it's like moon-shaped. Well, like this to you. It comes up, it's like moon-shaped, and that entire area is extremely, extremely fertile. Okay, they don't have to work very hard in order to get this place growing good crops. The same thing, although it's not very important to studying Western civilization, but the people of the Indus River Valley in India also had an incredible civilization that sprung up about this time, and also the Chinese people of the Po River, the Yalu River. The Po River is in Italy. But the Yalu River is also another great society, a Chinese society. Now, that's usually not studied in conjunction with Western civilization. Eastern culture is completely different, and they really don't have much of an impact on what happens with Greece and Rome and things like this, okay? So this is where we are. The sons of Noah, Ham, Shem, and Japheth. Now remember, we're talking about three basic categories of people. We're going to call them Hamitic, Japhetic, and Semitic. Now, as we go, we'll see that these peoples become very muddy. For example, we're going to see tonight that the Semites, the Akkadians, are going to come down and wipe out the Hamitic peoples, which are the Sumerians. When this happens, what you have is massive inbreeding, and the line kind of gets mixed up there. When you get into Babylon, you kind of have a mixture of the two. When you get into the later empires of Babylon under Nebuchadnezzar and Nabopolassar and some of these other kings, okay? But let's take a look at this now, the Sumerians. I gave you a handout. Will you turn to that, please? And Norm, would you come up for a second? This is an attendance sheet, something that we failed to do last week. You'll see the date for last week and this week. Would you just initial the block next to your name and the date? If you were here last week, initial last week's too. We're just going to pass this around. Here's a pen. Okay, now I gave you a handout that came hot off the press at 3:15 yesterday morning, so I hope you enjoy it. This is on the Sumerian peoples, and it's just kind of an overview, so let's take a look at it together. The Sumerians lived in the land between the Tigris and Euphrates River, known in history as Mesopotamia, or the land between the rivers. Tigris means arrow because of the way it flows as straight as an arrow, and your book told you about that. The Euphrates means that makes fruitful. Okay, pointing up the fact that it's an extremely fruitful, fertile place to live. The Sumerians were probably the descendants of Nimrod and therefore a Hamitic people. Now, if you have the time, and we don't have it in this class, but if you have the time, you can look at Genesis chapter 10 and it will break down for you who the sons of Shem, Ham, and Japheth are and where they settled. For example, it will tell you that Mizraim is the son of Ham, and he settles in Egypt, and he becomes the father of the Egyptians. We'll learn about him next week. But Ham had it's very unusual. Ham had a black son and a white son. The Canaanite peoples are a white race of Ham. Yet there are other sons of Ham. For example, Put. What a name, Put. Sounds like a bad football game. Put is ends up moving to Africa. So we have the black-skinned peoples that end up south of the Sahara Desert on the continent of Africa. Okay, so if you have time, you can go in, and we'll be filling you in on the biggies as we go along, but we certainly won't have time to break down Gomer and some of these smaller civilizations. But as far as like Mizraim, this is Egypt, and on it goes. Well, one of the sons, Nimrod, ends up in the Fertile Crescent. He ends up in Mesopotamia, and he starts building cities right away. One of the cities he's famous for building is Babylon. Another one is Assyria. And Assyria, what will become the capital of Assyria, Nineveh. And he's building these cities. He's an early city builder. And many of his descendants, most people believe that, for example, when the Tower of Babel comes along, that it's all of those people, many of them are all Hamites. Okay, and the people who are ruling the civilization are Hamites, and they end up spreading out throughout all of the world after the dispersion. Okay, and we get into some of the accomplishments. The Sumerians constructed dikes, dams, and canals for irrigation and flood control. They're the first people in the world known to have used the wheel. Sir Leonard Woolley was a very famous archaeologist, and he uncovered some of the most amazing things. When he went into Ur, and Ur, of course, is the land where Abraham is from, and when he went to Ur and he started excavating Ur, he found children's toy chariots with that you could attach a string to and pull around a room on wheels. Okay? So they're the first known people to have used the wheel. Woolley uncovered also beautifully crafted musical instruments such as stringed harps that was once a royal cemetery. Such skillful work was clearly thousands of years ahead of its time. In this royal cemetery that he uncovered, he actually found some of the musicians still had their, what they would do is they would bury, when a king died, all of their servants would be buried with them. And they would have, when a king died, it was a sad time for the people of these lands, because all of their servants and everything would be buried along with them. So what happened is, and then they would just basically just backhoe the whole thing, just totally just fill it in. And what happened is some of the musicians still had their hands on the strings, or where the strings would have been playing their instrument when they were uncovered. Okay, considering the trade that predominated the Euphrates and Tigris rivers, it is not unlikely that the Sumerians also invented the sail. When we get to Ur a little bit later down here, we're going to see that Ur became extremely wealthy at the time of Abraham. Abraham was no peasant. Abraham was in fact, he was extremely wealthy aristocracy of the third dynasty of Ur. And when Abraham left Ur, he was leaving behind, this was prosperity he was leaving. He wasn't leaving, in the time of slavery. He was leaving at a time when he was extremely prosperous and wealthy, and we'll see that a little bit later. But the way that the people of Ur got so rich is because they were right on the Euphrates River, and they had all kinds of trade going up and down that river. They were trading back and forth, and it was an incredible source of wealth for them, which leads many scholars to believe that they probably invented the sail as well to help them navigate that great river. The Sumerians are the first known people to have developed a system of writing. They developed a phonetic alphabet early, and they use a reed pen, which historians call a stylus. Basically, the way I want you to think of it is think of chopsticks. You ever see the ones that are like square? They're perfect little square ones. Well, if you take the corner of one of those square styluses, those wooden things, you can take it and just press the corner in, and it makes like a wedge. You put it in at a little bit of an angle, and it makes like a wedge. That's what they mean by the wedge-shaped writing. They had a square stylus, like, and they would take it and they would impress it into wet clay. Now, but when they did this, we start off with what we call a pictograph script. We have animals and things like this, and we'll learn more about this next week when we get into Egypt and the hieroglyphics and the Rosetta Stone. But what happens is we begin with a bird represents a bird. Okay, and then what happens is symbols begin to represent different words. A part of a symbol, a part of a bird, maybe like the underbelly of a bird. So a line going this way will represent a bird, you see? And language develops through a series of basically shortcuts. And the first people known to have done this were the people of Sumer. Another thing that's amazing about this is they also used to send messages to each other. Contracts to each other, and they had clay envelopes that they would put they'd make these little contracts in clay, and then they'd allow them to harden in the sun, and then they would slide them into these envelopes and mail them. And I saw that on a film that we have at the school just the other day that I showed the kids. It was unbelievably amazing. Okay, it says under point four, volumes of these cuneiform tablets have been found, and many of them have been deciphered. Tablets deciphered from the first 1,000 years of Sumerian history, which actually is tens of thousands of tablets, consist primarily of business records and transactions and administrative records. The tablets from the second 1,000 years of their history, which is after 2000 BC, provide us purely with literary texts. The most famous one, and I thought it was worth mentioning here, is something called the Epic of Gilgamesh. The Gilgamesh Epic is it's a tough call for a lot of, it's a tough spot for a lot of Christians, because what the Gilgamesh was this guy right here, he was a pre-Diluvian legendary king, before the flood, pre-Diluvian legendary king, and he lived, supposedly, according to Sumerian myth, he lived and he fought unbelievable monsters, and it's kind of like our fantasy stories that we even have today, but he did all these things. But the most amazing part of the Gilgamesh epic is that he becomes involved in an unbelievable flood, and he talks about how the gods tell him to build a boat, and he builds this boat, which engineers tell us is not seaworthy. The way the ark, which is described in Genesis chapter 6 and following, is one of the most seaworthy vessels that you could ever put in the water, and engineers have proved this. But what he tells us he built and that he was saved from this ark in is not considered to be seaworthy. However, the problem with this is supposedly the Epic of Gilgamesh predates Moses by quite a few hundred years. So the question comes along to Christians is, well, one of the chief things in apologetics is, well, if you say that, if you're telling me all of this about your Bible, what about the Epic of Gilgamesh? I mean, that was all Moses did was rip off Sumerian myth. Well, this is extremely debatable, and I'll tell you why. Because we're going to learn when we get into our week in Assyria, there was a very famous Assyrian king who collected a massive, massive library, okay? When he collected this library, he had a copy of the Gilgamesh epic in it. And that is the oldest copy that we have of this epic. And it claims to be Sumerian. Okay, but we can't really prove that because the oldest copy that we have only comes from the Assyrian civilization, which was wiped out in 612 BC, much long after Moses. Okay, so does everybody understand that? So what many people will try to say, as a matter of fact, it wasn't even a month ago, I was listening to this one of these shows on the radio that where people call in and they ask questions about the Bible and why is this like this, I don't remember the name of the show now, but somebody called in and said, what about the Gilgamesh epic? Somebody told me about that there were stories of the flood before Noah. And the guy was really sharp, and he brought this point out beautifully, that the oldest copy that we have of this thing comes from the libraries of Assyria, not Sumer. That's very important. If we had found these things in Ur, it'd be a different story. We'd have to come to the, I'm sure there would be an answer, because we know that the Bible is absolutely true. But the bottom line is, that's important to remember in the back of your mind, okay? Textual criticism is very important when looking at history. Okay, F, they invented bronze and they cast it into molds so that they could make weapons and tools. This is the Bronze Age right here, what we call in history the Bronze Age. They used mathematics for far more than just counting. They understood and used square roots, fractions, geometry, and cube roots. They set up schools called tablet houses in which they were instructed by teachers called the father of the tablet house. Any discipline... Pretty original, huh? Any discipline problems were dealt with promptly by a monitor call. Now listen to this. Brother with the big stick. It was in these schools that students were educated in the arts of writing and mathematics, and no doubt this is exactly where Abraham went to school. He learned it probably like any other child in Ur, and that was in these schools, these tablet houses. Sumerians built beautiful ziggurats. You saw in your book the pictures of the ziggurats, the way they were one tier, getting smaller all the way to the top. It's very, very beautiful the way that they have uncovered these for us in Mesopotamia. In Ur, one of the most massive ziggurats have been uncovered. The ziggurat of Ur was 200 feet long, 150 feet wide, and 70 feet high during Abraham's day. At the top of this imposing structure stood a shrine dedicated to the worship of Nana. Now, what would happen is a worshiper would take their whatever they wanted to use to pay homage to their god. In Ur, it happened to be Nana, the moon god. And one god owned a city. That's the way it worked back then. One city belonged to one god. One god didn't mess with another god. If they did, there was war, and the god that wins is the god of both the cities, okay? But what happened is you would go up, and you would offer your sacrifice or whatever to Nana, and you would come back down. Now, we can only imagine that Abraham must have watched as his friends, and before God called him, who knows, maybe he walked up into those pagan rituals and walked up and offered their sacrifices to these false gods. And, you know, it's really unusual because we're going to see there's not a whole lot of difference between the ziggurats and then the step pyramids in Egypt. We're going to see the step pyramids, then the mastabas, and then the pyramids proper, like the pyramid at Giza and all of these, the pyramids that we know so well, the Great Pyramid. So there's really not a lot of difference. If you know, they've all got this kind of idea. Now, this has led many scholars to believe that because of the tiers, you have a larger tier at the bottom, smaller, 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 till you get to the top. Well, what's on the top? The altar to the god, right? So this has caused many scholars to believe that this building was a symbol of the hierarchical structure of the society, meaning the god was at the top, the king would be the next level, and then his administrators would be the next level. And finally, when you get to the bottom level, it's always Joe Turnip Picker, picking his turnips and haggling for 20 cents an hour. Okay. The civilizations in Mesopotamia were characterized by frequent fighting. And what we're going to do now is we're going to take a look at a couple of things here. First of all, two great pre-Diluvian Sumerian kings. I just want you to have an idea of who these guys were. The first one we've already talked about, Gilgamesh. He's very important, especially in literature. This is like the first genuine piece of literature that man has ever produced, the Epic of Gilgamesh, okay? The second one is Thammuz. Tammuz, Tammuz. And Tammuz is important to mention too because he is supposedly a king who lived before the flood, and he becomes important because the people of Mesopotamia deified him, and he ends up being the god of vegetation. So as we study history in Mesopotamia, Tammuz comes up a lot. That name comes up a lot. And it's a god. Many of the gods, remember now, once they've been a king for a while, many of the kings later become gods. It's not much different than the New Age movement. I mean, if you want to regress back into Mesopotamia, just get a hold of some of the New Age people. But what would happen is, if they were a great king, the people would turn them into a god. And this is what happened with Tammuz. So these are two important people we should know. One early post-Diluvian king, now we're talking about after the flood, is Uruk Agina. Uruk Agina is the way it's pronounced, of Lagash. And I want to read you this. I want to read you about him. This is from a book by Will Durant called The Story of Civilization in his chapter on the Sumerians. It talks about the fact that he was indeed a great king, and he says, if I can find the page here it is. It says one king, Orichagena of Lagash was a royal reformer, an enlightened despot who issued decrees aimed at the exploitation of the poor by the rich and everybody by the priests. The high priest, says one edict, must no longer come into the garden of the poor old mother and take wood therefrom, or gather taxes in fruit therefrom. Burial fees were to be cut by one-fifth of what they had been, and the clergy and high officials were forbidden to share among themselves the revenues and the cattle offered to the gods. It was the king's boast that he had given liberty to his people. So the reason that I thought that that quote was amazing is because we have a very early king now of Sumer, but do you see how civilization is? This guy is concerned very early with his people. And we're going to see that's not going to happen in Egypt for quite some time. He's concerned with his people. People were obviously getting ripped off by religious people. Nothing's changed. They were getting ripped off by religious people. I guess the priest would come into the house and he would say, a bushel for the monastery. And he'd walk away with all the goods that he needed or whatever. And this king made very early reforms to stop this. Now this king was overtaken by the next guy that we have on our list here. This king was overtaken by Lugal Zagizi. Some of these names are tough. Lugal Zagizi. He attacked Lagash, he overthrew Urukagina, and he sacked the city at the height of its prosperity. Temples were utterly destroyed, citizens were slaughtered in the streets. The statue of the gods were carried off into Egyptian bondage. The Sumerian poet, Dayang Ramadu, mourned for the city and wrote this. Listen to this. The guy's city had just been wiped out. The guy probably has just got done watching many of his people get killed. He's definitely watched women and children being slaughtered. And this is what this ancient poet writes. He says, "For the city, alas, the treasures, my soul doth sigh. For my city, Lagash, alas, the treasures, my soul doth sigh. For in holy Lagash, the children are in distress. Into the interior of the splendid shrine he, the invader, has pressed. The august queen from her temple he brought forth. O lady of my city, desolated, when wilt thou return?" Now that's early, that's very early poetry. And you can you see the high degree of literary value that has? Now obviously it's going up to a foreign god, but what I want to show you is the early civilization, the way they're beginning to think, the way that they're putting things together, thinking intelligently, and being able to communicate themselves to people. Remember, once writing starts, the floodgates open, and everything really begins from there. All of the intelligence that we have really begins from there, and we really begin rolling. Okay, meanwhile now, while all of this has happened with Lugal, meanwhile in the north, in Akkad, remember Akkad up here? A-K-K-A-D? Akkad or Akkad, either way you want to pronounce it. Up north of, take the map that I gave you. Okay, if you see earliest Egypt and Mesopotamia, this map here that you hold this way, look at the land between the two rivers. It's right here. It's on this side. You see Ur, you see Eridu. Well, do you see to the north? Under quite a ways under Assyria, you see Akkad, okay? These are very early Semitic peoples, okay? And they're gonna be fighting constantly with the Hamites in the south. One guy that comes along is a guy by the name of Sargon the First, very, very famous. Sargon the First establishes his capital at Agade. He was not royal at birth. As a matter of fact, his mother was a temple prostitute. We'll learn more about that. Well, actually, I'll tell you about it now. In these ancient civilizations, what happened is they basically had temples that people would dedicate their daughters to, and the daughters would serve as prostitutes for these gods. And this was one of the greatest honors. Now listen, not all women were accepted. Not all girls were accepted. A father would bring his daughter to the priest, and they would either accept or reject them. And they were not all accepted. And it was one of the greatest honors is to offer up your daughter in this kind of thing. Well, the mother was nothing more than a temple prostitute. So we're not talking about a guy who had extremely noble birth here. As a matter of fact, his father is basically unknown in history. We don't know anything about him. He is called Sargon the Great because of the many cities he conquered, the treasures he plundered, and the many men that he slew. One of Sargon's victims was Lugal. Remember Lugal? bloodthirsty Lugal? Well, he was one of his first victims, and he sacked the one who had sacked Lagash and violated the goddesses. Sargon carried him off in chains to Nippur in the north. He subdued cities to the north, south, east, and west, conquering anyone and everyone in his path with his mighty war machine. When he conquered Elam in the east, the Elamites were to the east. If you see on that map, see where Iran is, all the way to the east? That's where the Elamites are. They're very important. They're the ones who are going to eventually wipe out the Sumerians. Okay? The Elamites, he conquered Elam in the east, and then he washed his weapons in the Persian Gulf as a symbol of his triumph. He crossed Western Asia and reached all the way to the Mediterranean Sea, thereby establishing the first great empire in history. He retained power for 55 years, and legends were quickly gathered about him in preparation of making him a god. But his life ended with his entire empire in revolt. And he makes this disease, the Red Death, the antagonist of his story. But another thing is, it's very important because during the Black Plague, we immediately have the Great London Fire, 1666, I believe it was, an incredible fire that swept through London and basically burned everything down. But it also cleansed it. So fire wasn't really that bad of a thing if you weren't living there. That's one of the reasons why we have so many of the buildings left that we do today. Sumer regains its power at this time, though, because of this guy Gudea. He's important, and you've got his picture in your book here somewhere. He's let me see if I can find it for you real quick. He's kind of funny looking, but let me see. Page 20. That's what we're looking for. There he is, Gudea, king of Lagash. Okay? He's important because now all of a sudden the people in the north, and I understand that a lot of this stuff is grueling. I know it is. But it's important that we see how all of a sudden the Hamitic peoples are going to be interspersed with the Semitic peoples. This is going to really set the stage. It's not next week so much because we're going to be going to a different place and looking at Egypt for a week. But this is going to be extremely important when we get into the Canaanites. If I didn't give you this tonight, you really have a tough time understanding what happens with the Canaanites. Okay. So Gudea of Lagash, he was honored by his people. He was kind of a different ruler. He wasn't honored by his people as a great warrior, but rather as a man devoted to religion, literature, and good works. And we all know what good works get you. An interview with Oprah Winfrey. He built temples. He built beautiful temples. And he united the Sumerians about 2050 B.C. He united them against the onslaught. Once the people from the north, the Akkadians, had begun to fall apart, what Gudea is able to do is unite the Sumerians and say, hey, man, we've been kicked around for too long. And what happens is these cities, Aradu and Aruk and Lagash, and all of these cities begin to come together, and they realize, hey, listen, let's start thinking as a common people, and maybe we can get this problem taken care of. He promoted the study of classical antiquities. He was revered and worshipped as a god after his death. An inscription which was left to him reads like this. This is an inscription that was left written to him after he died. It said, during 7 years, the maidservant was the equal of her mistress. The slave walked beside his master. And in my town, the weak rested beside the strong. So what we have is what? We have an incredible guy, again, who's doing what? Thinking about people. This is what civilization is, folks. We're beginning to think. We're beginning to write. We're beginning to express ourselves. We're beginning to do more than throw stones at each other. Oh, and I'll tell you something else. Wait till we get to Canaan. They were actually, in fact, I can even slip that in tonight. I found something today, studying today, that I really believe that there were some Sumerians who believed in some kind of theory of evolution. I'm going to read that to you before we leave tonight. But they, in the schools, I'll have to read it to you. In the schools, they taught, I got to tell you this. In the schools, here's what they taught. In the schools, they taught that man was not always as he is now. Once, his arms dragged on the ground. And he didn't put food to his mouth because he didn't know how to eat. He just eventually learned how to eat off the trees without taking... He had to go on the tree because he didn't know how to take the... Okay, so now we know that Darwin was a Sumerian. You didn't think you'd learn anything here. Okay, so anyway, Ur is earth. Finally, what happens now is we have this great period of Gudea. We have to know about him. Then all of a sudden, now we get to Ur, and we're going to be wrapping things up very quickly. Ur becomes the Mecca of Sumeria. This is not a little small insignificant town in Mesopotamia. This is where our father Abraham comes from, and this is the kind of land, these are the kind of people that he spent time in these schools, learning education, learning how to write, learning square root, cube root, learning geometry, learning fractions. He spent time studying ancient literature, the Epic of Gilgamesh. Of course he knew all about that, supposedly. All of these things is the place where our father Abraham comes from, which is also an industrial mecca of the world now because of the trade that's been brought in by coming up with the sail, coming up with the wheel, and being able to transport goods to and fro up and down the Euphrates. Okay? We have a multi-millionaire here, Father Abraham. Open your Bibles, if you have them with you, to Genesis chapter 12. Genesis chapter 12. Ur of the Chaldees now enjoys a time of awesome prosperity and overshadows Lagash. There the greatest king, Ur-Enger, brought all of Western Asia under his power. He devised the first extensive code of laws in history, and he wrote, by these laws of righteousness, Shamash, forever I shall establish justice. Shamash was his god, with the god of lights. He also built beautiful temples and extensive buildings, and he had a program for building in cities that were subject to him, such as Uruk, Larsa, and Nippur. Ur became one of the wealthiest cities of the ancient world at this time because of an extensive trade network on the Euphrates. It was from here that God called Abram and instructed him to leave his relatives. Now, this is a little bit fractured, so follow this with me. In Genesis chapter 12, verse 1, it says, "Now the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country and from your relatives and from your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great, and so shall you be a blessing. And those who bless you shall I bless, and those who curse you shall I curse." Now I want you to stop there before you go any further, and I want you to go to Genesis 11:31, just probably on the other page. It says, because this kind of backtracks a little bit and gives us more information, "And Terah, which is the father of Abram, took Abram his son, and Lot the son of Haran his grandson, and Sarai his daughter-in-law, and his son Abram's wife, and they went together from Ur of the Chaldees in order to enter the land of Canaan, and they went as far as Haran and settled there. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran." So what happens now is Abraham is called out of, I want you to think, well, let me do this real quick. We're running out of time. But think of this as the Tigris-Euphrates, okay? Now, what he does is he's called from Ur, and he's called over here, way over in Palestine. This would be the Med. Okay? And he's called way over here in Palestine. What he's going to do is he's going all the way up to Haran. Okay? And then after his father dies, he's finally going to fulfill the command that God gave him, and he's coming all the way down here, and the Dead Sea would be down here, the Sea of Galilee, the River Jordan, the Dead Sea. And most of all of the rest of his life is going to be consisted right here inside of the land of Canaan, where the Canaanites dwell. Wait till you hear what they're like. I'll tell you one thing, sexual depravity, sexual perversity was the norm. And when we get into that, I'll show you in the Bible. The Bible tells you specifically, do not as the people of Canaan do. And then it goes on and it lists a whole tableau of things that they used to do. Of course, there was down here is Egypt, and he did make some trips into Egypt. Okay, wrapping up very quickly, this sets the stage now. We've taken a look at the early Mesopotamian civilizations, the Sumerian peoples, the Akkadians to the north. Remember, the Akkadians were Semitic, sons of Shem. The people down lower, the people more south, were the Hamitic peoples. And what's going to happen now is all of a sudden we've gone through Sargon and we've gone through Gouda and all of these people, but now all of a sudden this guy in the north is coming and his name is Hammurabi. And when he comes, he's going to give you an unprecedented empire which is fierce, mighty, and the world's not going to see anything like the likes of him until you come into the Assyrian civilizations. He's going to march over anything that stands. And we're going to see that he's basically going to take control of the whole world and become the master of the largest empire that the world has ever seen up to this point. Okay, so next time when we meet, we'll talk about Hammurabi for a few minutes, and then we get right into Egypt, and we're pretty much on schedule.